From the studios of 96.3 FM Freak Radio in Santa Cruz, California, you're tuned to the Weekly Freak Show. Please stay tuned for contact information at the end of this half-hour broadcast. But now, here's Diane Patterson performing this week's spotlight sound, Freedom, recorded live in Freak Radio Santa Cruz studios.
Okay, we see the corpses are the ones that are digging out the mother there at Big Mountain. And so this is for them, and also in commemoration of the incredible action at Seattle last November and all the work that went into that and the consciousness that was raised there. So for the grandmas, hey, corporate rule, that's all they ever taught us back in school. Well, there's mathematics, pharmac taxes, and history is grinding axes. Science is soulless, even art is controlled. Lest the people get a taste of some real freedom. I just want to chill and hear the sound of my own breathing. Yeah, freedom, we need freedom. Yeah, what's the meaning of this thing that we call freedom? Well, is it freedom to buy the new product line? Or is it freedom to rally out and speak my mind? November 30, 1999, I'd say the people got a taste of some real freedom. Yeah, the whole world was watching, Seattle was quaking, and the people got a taste of some real freedom. Yeah, freedom, come on, freedom, yeah, freedom, yeah, freedom. Well, our minds are trained by ads and shows. The food is all chemicals and old horse bones. Our brains are all dead, hungry, or overfed. I think it's time we leave them all and get some fresh air. Addicted zombies and they're looking with a blank stare. Yeah, freedom! Come on, freedom! Freedom! Whoa, 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 freedom! Yeah! Freedom, tall trees and freedom, yeah. Freedom, break out! Freedom, check out! Freedom, break out! Freedom, break out, shake out, break out!
Stephen Zunis is a professor at the University of California, San Francisco, in the Political Science Department. He is also the chair of the Peace and Justice Program at the school and will be traveling to Pristina, Kosovo, in the near future to do a nonviolence training. He joined Freak Radio's John Malkin for a discussion on the recent nonviolent revolution in Yugoslavia. He begins with some history of nonviolent struggle in the region.
Well, this is actually the third major nonviolent uprising against the Milosevic regime. The first two failed in large part because a lack of Western support. Indeed, the new president swept into power, who had been voted in an election that Milosevic tried to undo unsuccessfully, Kostunica, basically said quite outright that the United States had backed Milosevic against the people of Yugoslavia when they tried to fight for their freedom. Richard Holbrooke, Clinton's special representative to the Balkans and now the United States representative to the United Nations, had Milosevic as our go-to guy for peace and security in the region. You can see this in his autobiography about his role in the Bosnian negotiations. And basically the word was, let's not push Milosevic too hard. It's good to have the guy in. He's strong. He's powerful. Let's not let if the Democrats take over, there's no telling what's going to happen. And indeed, the people of Kosovo felt particularly betrayed because it was widely believed that with the pressure on Milosevic, as it was in 1995, that he'd be forced to grant autonomy back to the Kosovar Albanians. However, the United States did not want to proceed with that. And in other words, the U.S., and to a lesser extent the European allies, kept Milosevic in power long after the Serbians themselves would have swept him away. the NATO policy kept him in power even longer when they switched to the other extreme and began the heavy bombing campaign of Serbia. Now, again, this was done in the name of trying to protect the Kosovo Albanians, but it was not like we sent in a few crack divisions into Kosovo to try to protect the Kosovo Albanians who were being slaughtered. Instead, it was mostly high-altitude bombing hundreds of miles to the north of Kosovo against Yugoslavian cities, the very cities that happened to be the heart of the opposition to Milosevic. And more than 500 civilians were killed, according to estimates by Amnesty International, the International Red Cross, and other reputable international organizations. And, of course, not surprisingly, when your country is being bombed, you tend to rally around the flag. It set back the nonviolent movement many, many months. Indeed, Milosevic had, in many ways, created the latest round of the Kosovo crisis because he felt his days were numbered, and of course NATO fell right into his trap, and indeed artificially perpetuated his rule long after he should have been out of there, and with great destruction of the infrastructure of Yugoslavia in the process.
The nonviolent movement in Serbia to oust Milosevic, as you mentioned, has been going on for some time. In the winter, was it 1996?
Yes, people took to the streets. It was a very remarkable show of opposition, hundreds of thousands of people suppressed by the police. Never quite got that critical mass, again, because certain key elements of the military and elite, finding continuing support from the United States and the West, felt they could hold on and outlast the opposition. This time, however, Western countries had actually put in some money to some of these very NGOs. They finally had the support they needed to run their presses, to organize. They had the resources they had asked for many years and not gotten. In addition, the elites knew they weren't having the backing of the West anymore. So at this point, the meeting, the movement was successful. And yes, there were some very very creative acts of nonviolent resistance by the opposition, but it wasn't significantly larger than what we had seen earlier. Just this time, the West, instead of backing Milosevic, stayed back and, in fact, in certain ways helped the opposition through financial aid in the preceding months.
President Clinton, and I heard this echoed throughout Santa Cruz and throughout the United States in the press, was this idea that we need to do something to help the Kosovar Albanians and help bring democracy. And, in fact, what you're describing is a movement to oppose democracy.
Very, very much so. I mean, the United States has never been, anybody who's followed U.S. foreign policy in recent years, and in fact for many decades going past, has found the U.S. has rarely supported truly democratic movements, has rarely objected to oppressive regimes. In fact, just one example, the President Clinton and Madeleine Albright kept repeating this line: "We cannot allow such oppression to take place, in adjacent to NATO countries." When in fact, very similar oppression to what the Serbs are doing to the Kosovar was happening on an even worse level in Turkey against the Kurdish population. In fact, there's some remarkable parallels: the denial of social and cultural rights, denial of the right of the use of the language in government, suppression of even nonviolent movements, destruction of villages, mass relocation of refugees, large-scale killings of civilians. And yet, not only did the United States not come in defense of the Kurds, but the United States has sent arms and aid to the Turkish military, facilitating that kind of repression. Now, the Kosovar Albanians had been resisting the Serbs ever since Milosevic revoked their autonomous status in 1989. And under leadership of Ibrahim Rugova and other ethnic Albanians, Albanian leaders within Kosovo, they engaged in one of the most comprehensive nonviolent movements since Gandhi. not just in terms of nonviolent protests, but in setting up a very elaborate network of alternative institutions, parallel institutions, essentially a parallel government that was democratically elected when the Serbs wouldn't allow them into the government, into the civil service, into the universities. Thus, all the schools were shut down. The Albanians set them up for themselves, a remarkable form of massive nonviolent resistance. They begged for help from the West, some financial support, some diplomatic support. None of it was forthcoming. And certain elements within the ethnic Albanian population, particularly the more militant elements, who themselves were ethnic chauvinists in many respects, joined this what had originally been a very tiny shadowy armed group called the Kosovo Liberation Army, or KLA. And when with the civil strife in the neighboring nation-state of Albania led to the free flow of Kalashnikovs across the border, they were able to launch an armed resistance against the Serbs. That had several negative consequences. One, it just gave the Serbs an excuse to crack down with even greater brutality as part of a counterinsurgency war. But what's most striking to me is that then and only then did the United States and the West suddenly take notice of the plight of the Kosovar Albanians. And it makes me think, what kind of message were we giving to oppressed people around the world? If you use nonviolence, we'll ignore you. If you take up arms, then and only then will we pay attention to your cause and perhaps come to your aid. And indeed, it encourages, that kind of attitude encourages rebellion, armed rebellion, encourages violence, encourages the kind of hatred and bitterness that we now see in Kosovo to this day. I should also mention that the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which is consists of all the European countries, NATO and non-NATO, including Russia and some of the former communist states of Eastern Europe, brought in unarmed monitors, which in the fall of 1998, where they were able to operate, there was a dramatic de-escalation of the repression, de-escalation of the violence on both sides. However, NATO did not support them. They not only did not give them enough money, they didn't have enough trained monitors. Milosevic was willing for them to bring in a lot more. They just didn't have the financial resources or the training or the personnel to do so. NATO refused to offer them night vision binoculars, helicopters, the kind of thing that would have made which would greatly enhance the possibility this monitoring effort could have been successful. As a result, it was only partially successful. The violence continued and even escalated, and with that, the United States and the NATO powers gave the ultimatum at Rambouillet, which the Serbs rejected, which then gave NATO the excuse to launch their 11-week bombing campaign.
That's all the time we have for this week's program. Thanks for listening. The Weekly Freak Show is produced live in the studios of 96.3 FM Freak Radio in Santa Cruz, California, and can also be heard in Dade City, Florida at 102.9 FM, in the Twin Cities region at 94.1 FM, and in Berkeley, California at 104.1 FM. The Weekly Freak Show can be reached at P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. That's P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061, or send email to frsc@microradio.net. That's frsc@microradio.net. And don't forget, you can always listen to the many fine shows on Freak Radio by pointing your browser to www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. Our theme music was composed and performed by Neil Norman and his Cosmic Orchestra. For John Malkin, The Fish, and everyone at Freak Radio, my name's the V-Man, and that's a wrap.